I am privileged in the disability community. I look disabled from the outside. I am palatable to the media and to the outside world as a disabled person. I fit the narrative.
Hello and welcome to Disability Done Different, Candid Conversations. My name is Evie Norfell and today I am solo in the studio because Roland is posy with the Coco. But if there was ever a time to be hosting by myself, it's today because I'm joined by the wonderful Ellie de Marchelier, who you may recognise from such TV appearances as The Project Q&A and also a stint co-hosting The Drum. If you're not familiar with Ellie's work, she's a proud disabled woman. She was the national spokesperson for the Defend Our NDIS campaign during the 2022 federal election. And she's a fierce advocate for disability rights, which we're going to dig into a bit today, as well as in our conference, which is coming up on 1-2 June, both in Sydney and online. So you can register for that online. But welcome, Ellie.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. All girls episode. Love it.
And Ellie, some of the questions I've got for you might seem familiar for you because they're variations on questions that you wrote yourself, actually, for another podcast that you did with Elle Gibbs with The Commons. So we'll link to that in the show notes because it was a really interesting conversation.
Elle and I have weekly conversations on the weekend. We usually call each other on Sunday, and I felt like that podcast was just a recording of our weekly Sunday conversation. So it's a good one to listen to.
Yeah, awesome. Well, I thought it might be fun to turn some of the questions that you asked Elle on you because they're great questions.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
And so let's start with talking about the role of fun in activism. So you've mentioned that you think fun is a really important and often overlooked element of activism. Yes. Can you tell us a bit more about that and where you see it being done really well?
Well, no one wants to join your cause if you're not having a good time. Who wants to join a cause that is down and serious and looks like a whole lot of hard work without any reward? I think I got that. I don't know if it was from the Obama campaign, but it definitely, the Obama campaign was one of the first that exuded that feeling of, we're having a good time. Why wouldn't you want to join us? You're missing out if you aren't part of this. Campaigning should be fun. Campaigning should be about fighting for what you believe in and fighting for something you care about. It shouldn't be all hard work and no reward. I truly believe campaigning should be fun. And I brought that to the Defend Our NDIS campaign. I made, there was a big night in event that we held, and I said to the campaign team, we're not going to just have a debate of politicians and, you know, a serious conversation. We're actually going to have musicians. We're going to make it look like a late night show. We're going to have musicians. We're going to have social media influencers. We're going to have a party, because the disability community has been fighting for 3 years against independent assessments for the NDIS. Like, we've been fighting really hard. And so, I know, a little bit of fun goes a long way.
Yeah, I have a bit of a follow-on question for you. It's something that I personally think about quite a lot, which is about the role, kind of conversely to that, of anger in activism. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Oh, I think anger has its place in activism. I think there's always a place for anger. You know, there is an injustice if you are being an activist in something, and you have to be angry at injustice in the world. But you also need to know how to channel that anger. You can't just be angry and let that anger take you in places that aren't strategic. So I think if you can have your moment of anger, acknowledge that it's totally justified to be angry, but then channel it somewhere really strategic, then you've used your anger in the right way.
I know you're super passionate about the importance of having people with disability at the table in activist spaces, in political spaces. What are the key things that you think needs to change to make that more accessible?
Well, simply, we just need to be given a seat at every single table where decisions are made about our lives. It's that simple. We just simply cannot be not at the table. But we have to be at the table where decisions are made about our lives in every single forum. And I think we have to be given a voice in the media when they're talking about programs that impact our lives. There shouldn't be a story written about the NDIS that doesn't have a quote in it from a person with disability who is on the NDIS. I'm sick of reading articles that quote a whole bunch of able-bodied people about how the NDIS is unsustainable and not working, but it doesn't actually talk to anybody who's on the NDIS. So at every stage, people with disability have to be invited in and have to have a voice at every stage. It has to happen. And it's on people like journalists, it's on politicians, it's on bureaucrats, it's on service providers, it's on everyone to make sure if I'm in a room and decisions are being made about people with disability, is there a person with disability here? No. Okay, well, the decision can't be made. It's that simple.
Mm-hmm. And who do you think are the underrepresented voices in the disability community?
Look, I think people with intellectual disability are very underrepresented. I think people with psychosocial disabilities are incredibly underrepresented. I know that for me, as someone with a physical disability, I am privileged in the disability community. I look disabled from the outside. I am palatable to the media and to the outside world as a disabled person. I fit the narrative. And it's people who don't fit the narrative of what disabled looks like or sounds like who are underrepresented. But there are so many areas where there is no one with disabilities ever that we need anyone and everyone to step up and be there.
Mm-hmm.
I say that to acknowledge my own privilege here.
Yeah.
From the waist up, I look like an able-bodied human being. I make people feel comfortable with being around disability. Even though I'm in a wheelchair, even though I'm neurodiverse, I have autism and ADHD, that no one can see that. I mask incredibly well. I'm a white, 30-year-old woman who can present incredibly well. And, I make people feel comfortable with disability. I don't push them by my visual image out of their comfort zone. I acknowledge that I am privileged. It is the people who instantly push people outside their comfort zone or that have intersecting marginalization that have real problems being able to get a platform and a voice. And, I'm a queer person with disability, but again, you can't see that. So it's First Nations people with disability. It's called people with disability. That, again, that extra level of marginalization makes people feel uncomfortable. And so that means that they're less likely to be given a voice and to be given a platform that I will be given because I fit a palatable mold and I acknowledge that. Now, some people will say, because I fit that palatable mold, I shouldn't use my voice and I shouldn't use the platforms I'm given. Now, I disagree with that because people with disability are so lacking in representation and in opportunities to have our voices heard that every single person with disability that is given an opportunity to speak and to, raise our issues and raise problems that our communities face should absolutely do that. And that is what I'm doing. And I'm hoping that by doing that, I am creating more opportunities for other people with disability. But I do that knowing that I come with incredible privilege.
That's a great answer. A topic that we've asked a few of the people on the podcast so far that I now want to ask you, now that we're talking a bit about your identity as a proud disabled woman, is about the topic of pride. And I'm wondering if you can talk a bit about the relationship that you have to pride as a queer person and a disabled person.
Well, look, I think I came to the place of I have incredible pride about being disabled and about being queer, but disability in particular. I'm incredibly proud to be disabled, but it wasn't always like that. I think I came to that in my early 20s. In particular, I came to that because when I left high school, I went into work pretty much straight away, and I didn't want to be pigeonholed in work as the disabled advisor working in disabled policy. And so I did everything and anything to not be the disabled colleague, the disabled worker. And I did that for as long as I could. But around the time of my early 20s, I had a few bad work experiences where I suffered workplace discrimination because I was disabled. And it was because of those experiences that I realized no matter how hard I worked at not being the disabled advisor and not being pigeonholed, I was going to be. That was just the reality. And I could either embrace all of the incredible assets that came with that and use that as a teachable moment, or I could continue to run and hide and be scared. And I didn't want to feel that way anymore, and I didn't want to feel like I couldn't be my whole self at work. And so I'm actually moved into disability work, doing disability advocacy policy work. One of the first things I did was actually reshoot my headshots for work, and I made sure that my wheelchair was in my headshots because I'd actually gone for jobs and gotten jobs and then rocked up for the first day and they'd said, "Oh my God, your team works upstairs." Like, I'd done such a good job at hiding the disability that they hadn't realized that I couldn't be on the same level as my team. And so I wanted my headshots to say this woman is proudly disabled. So that was when I did my first bits of advocacy, I think. And that was in my early 20s.
It's a big journey to go on now. I made an offhand comment the other day. Someone was asking about who works in the disability sector. And I said something like, you know, people with disability are more likely to work in the disability sector because I just assumed it. And someone quickly cut me off and was like, actually, that's not true. Actually, in the disability sector, there's fewer people with disability working than in other industries, which I found really interesting. And not that you necessarily work in the sector, it's kind of like in the broader disability community and ecosystem. But reflecting on the experiences that you had in other jobs where you experienced discrimination, have you found working in a more disability-focused role is better?
Not always, no.
Yeah.
I've found just as much discrimination in disability roles as I have in outside of disability. But I've found that when you come at it from a place of pride and you know that you are allowed to be disabled at work, that it's okay that you are disabled at work, how you handle those situations is so much different than being scared and feeling like you're doing the wrong thing and you shouldn't be disabled at work, and you know, the mindset is completely different. And so no, I don't think the disability sector is any less discriminatory against people with disability. Actually, I think it can be worse, because I feel like the disability sector is sometimes sees people with disability as its problem that it's trying to solve. And so when there is a person with disability working in the organization, they treat the colleague as if they're the problem again, that is just trying to be maintained or solved rather than a colleague. I think the disability sector can actually be worse.
Those are some big cultural and attitude things that need to change, which we know change slowly.
They don't have to. That's the thing. They change.
Go on.
The systemic changes have to be done slowly, right? The segregation stuff, the ending segregated housing, ending segregated workplaces, ending segregated education, that has to be done over long transition periods with people with disability and government and workers or parents or whoever the stakeholders are, right? Systemic change has to be slow and deliberate, and it is hard. Cultural change does not have to be slow and hard. Cultural change simply means there are 1 in 5 Australians with disability. If you look around your life and you truly have a look at it, is there another person in your life with disability that is your equal? A colleague, a friend, a mum at the park, a friend at the football club. If you work at a place with more than 5 employees, is there a person with disability there? If not, why not? If you seriously can't find a single person with disability in your life that is your equal, you have, however unintentionally, segregated your life from people with disability. And how you change that is by purposely opening up a part of your life to a person with disability. And you can do that tomorrow. You can change that tomorrow. So cultural change doesn't have to take a long time. Cultural change can take days if we wanted it to. If everyone decided that they were going to unsegregate their life, that they're going to let people with disability in, that they were going to not have people with disability only being with people with disability over there, away from everyone else, that would create complete cultural change. It would, because everybody would have a connection to someone of their equal status, and a person with disability. It would completely change people with disabilities' lives. It would open up their lives from segregation. Right? It wouldn't change all the systemic stuff. They'd still have to go back to housing that's segregated. They'd still have to go back to workplaces that are segregated. But the cultural side of it, the communities would open up. And so the cultural side is actually the much more easier side to change. But it actually takes able-bodied people doing the work. Yeah. People with disability can do the systemic change work with governments and with stakeholders, but it's able-bodied people that have to do the work and have to make the change in order for cultural change to happen.
You're putting the challenge out. I like it.
How else do we make it? I don't see how else we can do it.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. And what you're saying is perfectly compatible when you compare to something like research around attitudes to LGBTIQA plus people. What really works to change people's mind is just meeting an LGBTIQA plus person and seeing that they're just a person, or having somebody in your family. And that's, I think, what some people attribute to having such significant change in attitudes towards LGBTIQA plus people compared to some other marginalized group, is because you're very likely to have a gay cousin, and so you just end up meeting people a lot more. But then, I mean, 1 in 5 people are disabled. That logic should follow there, which it doesn't.
But it's because so many people with disability are segregated.
Yeah,
and that's going to take able-bodied people opening up their lives and finding and going out and finding people with disability to open up their lives to, because we're not as integrated into society as LGBTIQ plus people. We're not, you know, in your workplaces, renting the house next door, or we didn't go to school with you. We went to segregated school. We went to segregated housing. We went to segregated workplaces. And that's the problem, right? But that's a systemic hard work that takes years. We can still do that cultural work now.
I want to segue a little bit from here. I want to ask you one of your questions now that you asked, Elle. Okay. I loved this question about what's a campaigning failure that really stands out to you. And I'm happy for you to choose either one of your own or one of somebody else's.
God, so many failures along the way. Like, can I say most campaigning doesn't really have an impact, right? Most of the busyness in a campaign, the day-to-day door knocking, the day-to-day phone calling, the day-to-day like busyness that you spend your whole waking time stressing about makes 0.1% of the difference in terms of an impact. And the amount of energy that goes into it is so huge. But then there are these moments of just nothing matters, nothing matters, nothing matters. And then you strike gold and there is this moment where you capture people's attention. And it's about just being able to stay the course during the quiet time where nothing seems to be getting through, and knowing that that is just building the foundation so that when the success hits, there's something there at the end of it.
But go on, give us a juicy one. When's times when someone does something you were like,
I worked in politics in my very early 20s, like in my teens, from the age of 17. And we ordered 30,000 of these flyers. And I swear that I ordered them in envelopes, but apparently order them in envelopes. And so these 30,000 brochures arrived, and I had to say to the then Deputy Premier, I don't care that you're the Deputy Premier. Everyone right now is stuffing envelopes. Get to stuffing envelopes, because we had about 12 hours to stuff 30,000 envelopes, which is a lot. Before we had to get it to Australia Post, and Australia Post is very hard with its deadlines. So we had, like, I think it was about 40 people overnight stuffing envelopes and licking them. This is pre-COVID, to get them to Australia Post in time, including the Deputy Premier, who I said to her, there is nothing more important than stuffing envelopes right now. So no one was important enough to get
That's
out of
hilarious.
It.
But yeah. Those times, you wind up looking back on those as being really fun times, no?
You did. And look, the amount of pizza and Coca-Cola and just like pure pump up music that you live off during a campaign is quite incredible. And so lots of pizza was ordered that night, lots of soft drink, and we just stuffed 30,000 envelopes.
Anya.
And I was just like, you know, swearing under my breath that I had definitely ordered them in envelopes. But anyway.
Ellie, it's been so fun to have a chat to you. I think that's a great place to end it, with the vision of you stopping 30,000 envelopes.
We did it. We did it. So the failure turned into success.
Yeah, that's awesome. And for those of you who want to hear more from Ellie, you're in luck, because Ellie's going to be speaking at our 2023 annual NDIS conference on 1st and 2nd June at the ICC Sydney and online. And I think you're going to be on a panel that Stan Grant is facilitating, right?
I know. Just like Q&A.
Yeah, it's going to be a juicy one. So yeah. Thanks so much for joining us today, Ellie.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thanks for helping me out while I solo co-hosted. Oh, well, just hosted, I guess they call that.
We rocked it.
I think so.
Yes.
You've been listening to Disability Done Different, a podcast by DSE that's produced by Maya Thomas. You can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or at teamdse.com.au/podcast. And I can't wait to see you at our conference, which I know you're coming to, aren't you, babes? So if you haven't, don't worry. You can still register at teamdse.com.au/conference. See you soon.